Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. This means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGG QA podcast channel. Ran out of air in the middle of the podcast name. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA is the important part because that stands for question and answer. So we like to make this an interactive conversation as we talk out some of the top tech news stories of the week. And this is going to be a slightly news-heavier show. I think a lot of companies are gearing up for Techtober. So all of the exciting product announcements, there are a bunch of leaks and stuff like that. But once you release an iPhone, it kind of sucks all the air out of the sails of the tech industry for a little while until everyone can kind of rebound and focus on more than just one company. It's funny, we can't really seem to ever talk about more than one company at a time. So folks, I hope you all had a fantastic weekend. I was super sick last week. I got like a nasty little head cold and I was giving myself like COVID tests the whole week just to try and make sure I still haven't picked up the Rona that I know of, but it was a gnarly sinus head cold. You can still kind of hear it in my voice. I'm going to try not to go 4 hours this week on this podcast. I know I always run long, but we're going to try and rein that in. This whole last week has been like downtime, just trying to get some rest. I've been doing a lot of writing, just trying to keep up with some of the projects that are going to be coming out soon. And a couple companies have been reaching out to try and talk about some other types of products that I want to start spreading the gadget love, not just always focusing on phones, but all of the other things we could be playing with too. So maybe a new pair of glasses might be coming to the channel soon. Maybe some new flash drives. Maybe I've got an adorable little mini PC over on that table there. I mean, these are things that could be. I can't really say for certain. No, there's no confirmation on any of this stuff. But Brian Glaze, man, come on. Incoming 4 hour podcast. Yeah. So, I usually this is a part of the show. I'm a little off my script because this is where I say, oh, over the weekend, we did all this fun stuff. You're like, no, I kind of sat on the couch and stared at the ceiling. And I did do just one fun outing with Lex, but it was more just let's go run some errands. And then we went to the mall. And a 7 year old, just, you know, out of a global pandemic, let me tell you, mall culture is coming back. I'm walking around like, wow, teenagers hang out at the mall. This is kind of amazing. It kind of took me back. You know, I'm walking by. There's an FYE, and here's a store just full of, like, comics and novelties. And, oh, look, Hot Topic is still in business. How is Hot Topic still in business? I really don't do malls much, but I was very surprised to see that. Like, as youth culture, malls are kind of a thing again. Hey, so what's up? We got a great crew already in here today. I see Michael Corcoran, Ghost Starscream, Bionic Scoop, Copcast, J-Man150, Brian Glaze already said hey. Dave Burns, Pacostin, Simon Says Hypno. Dave Burns, Juan is still recovering. Man, it's pretty tough. Grounded Tech? Oh my god, it's Grounded Tech! Mini Me 1231. The reality distortion field is strong this time of year. Fat Produce. So I got to do a special shout out to my buddy Andrew. He found this awesome baseball cap. And if anyone knows what this baseball cap is in reference to, then you are just as delightfully nerdy as Andrew and I are. He found this thing, and I did that like Simpsons gasp when he showed it to me. So he sent it my way. Major thank you to my buddy Andrew, because this baseball cap is pretty nerdcore. I even had to explain it to Marie. Marie did not get it. So I also have to throw some big shout outs over on the Twitch side. The soundboardless announcement of glory. Simon Says Hypno subscribed with Prime, subscribed for 29 months. Simon Says Hypno, what's up, buddy? Thank you so much. And J-Man150 is already at it, gifting tier 1 subs to M. Oculus and Rayland74. So thank you so much for all the support. We're apparently almost through level 1 of a hype train. I am so bad at the Twitch. I know I primarily, like, stream as the destination to the Twitch. That's where I like to hold the conversation. But when it comes to all of the Twitch mechanics, beyond just push broadcast and talk to camera, I'm super bad at all of that. So thank you so much. All of the support has been amazing. And hopefully we can clear up at least a level 1 hype train and we can get some fun little emotes going down into the Twitch chat. So we've got, like I said, a pretty news-heavy block. So I'd like to try and chew through the news side of this. And then if we want, we can kind of open up the second half, normally where we do my gadget block, you know, news block, gadget block kind of podcast structure. We can open this up for just a bit more Q&A. We're wrapping up the year. I've been playing with some Android betas. I've been sort of going back, looking at a few other phones that maybe I didn't cover as well as I felt I should have when they launched earlier in the year. It's just that time of year where we're trying to kind of get everything reset and ready for the second half of announcements and product releases. Let me take a quick drink of coffee here, and we'll knock out some housekeeping. We'll jump right in. We'll keep this hype train a rolling, a choo choo, a choo choo. Oh, another Fat Produce gifting tier 1 subs to Pakistan and Muppinish, and now we are clear. Hype train level 1 complete. Choo choo choo, MFers. I don't know how to make that sound cool. Well, having a cop. Woo! Alright, so because I was kind of down for the count last week, my production and release schedule was a little off, but we got a couple cool videos out, and then I also wrote an editorial, so I want to jump into a screen share here. We can chat about some of the housekeeping. I'm doing another sponsored video, just another partnership with 70Mai. They sent a really fun dash cam my way, and I know dash cams aren't like the sexiest or the most exciting technology. It's a camera you put in your car, but I find it ludicrous that so few automobile manufacturers actually help their customers with products integrated into the car to offer better lane guidance with recording of traffic incidents and those kinds of security camera, where you can set up cameras in your car to act as like a sentry camera. It is pants on head silly to me how few companies offer those as like upgrade packages for a car. In current year, it's still like, oh no, well, if something bad happens to your car, I guess there's nothing we can do about it. And you're like, but there are these other automobiles that you can do this cool stuff with. No, we don't know how any of this technology works. So increasingly, this kind of tech has actually been making its way into dash cams. And so for a very modest upgrade price, you can attach this little wedge thing right behind your rear view mirror in your automobile. And this newest generation of dash cams offer these things like sentry mode, motion tracking around your car when the car is off, now 4K HDR video recording. So 70Mai reached out and we put together a little video just kind of talking about what some of those upgrades look like and also sharing some of the samples. And again, I want to say it's kind of silly. This $200 dash cam, that's a pricey dash cam, right? $200 is a lot in the world of dash cameras. But it's a dual camera setup, and the front-facing camera on this 70Mai is a larger image sensor than what's in an $1,800 Pixel Fold. So if you'd like to see the footage of what a dash camera, what the dash camera footage looks like from a camera larger than a Pixel Fold camera while doing driving, you'll get a good sense of that from the video we put together. Moving right along! We also got to take a look at something really special here. This is the Cineaptic SE1 Preview. What the heck is a Ribbon headphone? I did not know that Ribbon headphones existed. I've heard Ribbon speakers. There are all these other sort of alternative methods of generating acoustic force, the way that we create pressure and ripples in air so that we can hear sounds. And there are all these different materials that we can, not just materials, there are all these different materials and drivers and magnets and things that we can wiggle to create vibrations in air. So I was aware of Ribbon speakers, and especially like Ribbon tweeters are pretty popular. And I'm a big fan of Ribbon microphones, having worked in recording. They are super silky, like, warm. Like when people say warm, it means anything. Warm can mean anything in the world of microphones. It's one of the reasons why I got so burnt out on reviewing microphones. Like, is this a warm microphone? Will this microphone make my voice sound warm? Is my voice warm? Do I have a warm voice? Should I pair a warm voice with a warm microphone? And the word doesn't mean anything anymore. It just means whatever I think warm means to make me sound good. That's it. It could be any definition of that. But in the world of recording, if you're working with someone who's a little bit more technical and analytical, Ribbon microphones are super smooth, almost to the point of being kind of dull, and they are very warm. They're known for really emphasizing frequencies that kind of land lush. So we got the Cineaptics. This is a Ribbon headphone, and you can see even in my little thumbnail, there are these little corrugated strips, and there are two of them per ear. And my experiences with Ribbon microphones would have led me to believe that this would be more something like a Meze 99, kind of a smooth but like detailed, a comfortable listening microphone. We did clear Hype Train level one. Let's get this emote out here on the Twitch. No, don't do that. I just want to show you've collect. Oh, we've collected all the Hype Train level one emotes. That's actually kind of a big deal. Here, I'm going to do all of them in one Twitch comment, and it's going to be real obnoxious. Here we go. One of them's a pug. It's adorable. And one's a cat in a hoodie. So now I'm just going to drop all of those in there, and I don't even know if they'll show up. In the chat. That looks ridiculous. Hype Lull, Hype Rogue, Hype Ranger. Okay, yeah, that's some real good podcasting there. And we also have to throw another JMan152 to Glass Floors and TED Talks Tech, gifting those tier one subs. Thank you so much, JMan150. You're rocking my socks, buddy. And again, all of the support here. This is absolutely incredible, especially for this little like rebel podcast that we've been running for years now, just that folks like to come hang out and really nerd out on some news. So wrapping up, you can get a better explanation of WTH a Ribbon headphone is in the video. I put all that together, but short story incredibly long. While I was expecting the Ribbon microphone equivalent of a headphone, what I got instead was one of the most aggressively detailed and articulate headphones I've ever heard near this price. there are elements and qualities to this headphone that are starting to compete with like the clarity I would expect of an electrostatic. Electrostatic headphones are crazy expensive. When I got to listen to the Odyssey electrostatic headphones, those were $4,500 headphones. And Cineaptic is not making a boutique, ultra-luxury headphone. So while this is an exotic way to make sound, a ribbon diaphragm is not common, the headphone itself sells for $199. So I really feel like this is something that is punching well above its price tag for folks who are like me, who are like really detailed, critical listening, articulate headphones, and you get all of the clarity and the information and the sort of vibrato and tremor of our music. This is something absolutely you should try and take a listen to if you ever get the opportunity to. And then wrapping all this up, I wrote kind of a long-ish editorial because I was sick as a dog. Hooray! Bark, bark. Folding phone durability, educating consumers and setting expectations. And this is a critical editorial on the marketing surrounding folding phones. I am very disappointed. And we've talked about this on the podcast. Like, for example, when the new Honor Foldable came out, I was very disappointed in the website showing off a foldable being used down at the beach. I feel that is borderline misrepresenting the durability of the product. So, if you're a marketing nerd like I am, where I came out of Hollywood casting for commercials and voiceover and stuff like that, I really do enjoy this kind of look or this kind of conversation surrounding how do we talk about products and what are the responsibilities of the manufacturers to properly educate consumers. Apple gets tagged for this pretty regularly, overrepresenting the durability of the iPhone. Samsung was tagged for this at one point. We need to properly set expectations by consumers, and consumers increasingly are not coming to us techies. You know, for the amazing crew that we have here in this chat, I have to believe all of you people that are watching this right now are those people in your circles of family and friends who become the good resources for better tech information. Broadly, consumers watch a commercial. If it's about their favorite brand, they agree with it. And then that's how they're educated about these products. So it really matters if Apple missteps and misrepresents the durability of their product, because that commercial is going to tell the consumer, we validate your use of this product in this way. So if you want to smash a cake into your phone at, you know, Mach 2, well, it was in the commercial. So Apple must be advocating that this is the level of durability we should expect from the iPhone. This is super precious with folding phones. I think we just saw, there was an analyst report. I want to say folding phones are now 1.4% of the global smartphone market. Someone please correct me on that. I was going to include it in this week's show notes, and then I got real newsy this week. That's not a lot. I mean, it is a lot. It's millions of handsets, right? It could be as many as like 50 million phones sold over the course of the year. But in a global market of over a billion phones being sold, and that doesn't always completely track the used and the resale and the refurb markets. We're talking about like sort of the main consumer portals for smartphone purchasing that analysts keep track of. The global smartphone market could be substantially larger if we could more accurately track and account for used sales and refurbished sales and the sort of repair market that attaches to that. Sorry. It's super precious that our advertising is right for folding phones and that the ads do a good job of showcasing the durability and the expected use of folding phones. And as much as I'm loath to admit this, if you would like to see a rare occurrence of Juan praising Samsung, this would be an article to check out, especially as we kind of go through that process of looking at every single manufacturer's ads and how they portray folding phones and how people should be expected to use folding phones, and whether or not we're even showing real people trying to use folding phones. I'm really tired of commercials of just like, the phone floats in space and then opens like a butterfly. And you're like, that's useless. We've had that for 5 years now. You're not instructing or educating the consumer at all. And it almost kind of misrepresents the product. Like, if you don't show someone actually opening the phone, they literally don't even know, like, how stiff is the hinge? How do you hold the phone when you open it? Can you flip open a Moto Razr like you could a classic Moto Razr? You know, that kind of stuff matters in how we present the product. So anyway, I wrote a really cranky editorial. Long story, even shorter. Hold on. Do we believe that foldables, let alone rollables or scrollables, will be the replacement for regular slabs? I do not. How do people in the chat feel? I believe folding phones are going to occupy a targeted premium niche. At the same time as we're coming out with folding phones, we're also coming out with a whole host of other portable display experience technologies. And I think it's likely that almost as many people who opt for a phone that can turn into a tablet are also going to consider things like glasses that turn your phone into a movie theater screen. I mean, the expected use of that experience isn't completely dissimilar. I'm sitting down in a place where I think it's safe to use a plastic bending screen, so I would like to interact with something that's larger. You could also make the argument, I'm sitting down in a place where it's safe to use some XR glasses, I'm plugging that into my phone, and now I've got a humongous television resource to occupy, I mean, to organize all of my information. There's obviously a lot of difference between those two experiences, but they compete with each other closer than you think they might. And so that's, to me, like, we're expanding on all of these conversations. I don't think the true competition of a folding phone is a tablet. You know, two separate devices. If we're trying to say you're driving the whole experience from one device, maybe the competition for a folding phone is some kind of headset or heads-up display or virtual reality gear or something like that. Let me take a quick drink of coffee. I'd love to see what some of your other thoughts are on that before we jump into the news. Oh, that's funny. From Awesome Possum. Unfortunately, hand feel was a metric I heard a lot of last week. I mean, it was like round after round after round of case reviews. Boy, howdy, do I not. I'm bad at case reviews. I can't. Does it protect the phone? Fine. Does it look good? I don't care. I can't. Dave Burns, if it's we assume the editorial is cranky, Juan. Yeah, that is kind of what I do. I keep telling people, and I use this as a sort of a threshold, like, how old are you if you get this reference? Like, I'm kind of becoming the Andy Rooney of tech editorials. And then I look to see, like, do you know who that is? Because I feel real old. Michael Corcoran, I don't know if foldables will even account for 10% of the market share. Currently, it's less than 1% of Samsung's market, including the flip. Because we've got Samsung, Motorola, because it's not one thing. Like Michael Corcoran is saying here, when we see these foldable market share commentaries, we're seeing tablets that turn into phones and phones that turn into pocket watches are all being combined. If it has a bendy plastic folding screen, they're not considering the form factor, they're calling all of those foldables. And to me, those are two fundamentally different consumer experiences. They should not be considered the same thing, even though they both have a hinge and they both fold and they both have bendy screens. But that's where we're at. That's how small the market is, that we're putting those two completely different experiences together just to make it sound like more people are jumping on this bandwagon. From Fat Produce, scrollable phones really seem less durable than foldable at present. I completely agree. And also, I don't know how many people are really going to appreciate the experience of a scrollable if it has to have a motor. Like, okay, I would like to have a bigger tablet space. Boop. As opposed to, I would like to have a bigger tablet space. Open. I would love to get rid of the crease. but I don't want to sit there and wait for the thing to like open up and then know that like the sides of the phone are radically more fragile and that there's a motor inside that's driving this opening experience, which if you drop that phone, I mean, you drop any folding phone, you're probably going to do some damage, but for a scrollable, that's even worse. And if you try and open it manually, like the engineering challenge of a scrollable to me is completely insurmountable. Simon says, Hypno says, the rising price of regular slab phones means they just can't drop the price on foldables. Well, we'll have to see, because the hinge is really one of the things that's mandating, because you've got to reorganize all the components, you've got to build, you know, the moving parts, all of that stuff gets crazy expensive. But I bet you into next year, we're going to start seeing some efforts or some moves towards price competition. I'm really glad that Google didn't undercut the Z Fold on the price of the Pixel Fold. I don't think Google should do that. I feel if you're going to make this a new product segment and it's supposed to be exciting for consumers and demonstrate something unique, then you don't hand the market to Apple on a silver platter. Because everyone's like, oh, well, if it were half the price and it were better and cheaper, then I would buy it. And then Apple rolls in and says, hey, our foldable is the price of an iPad Pro and an iPhone Pro plus 20%. It's better than those Android foldables. And they'll win. That's exactly how you hand the market over to Apple, is you make it look like the perception of Android is cheaper and lesser than, and they'll come out and charge way more for something that's very similar or something that's already on the market, and then all the consumers will go, you know what? I deserve the bestest. I don't want the cheap copycat that was here before Apple made the product. I want the real deal. So I'm going to go to that carrier store, and they're going to show me two foldables, and one's going to be $1,000 more than the other. That's the good one. Yeah, go Starscream. I'm definitely going to lose that battle. Go Starscream says, it triggers me when techies call the Fold a foldable phone, when in actuality it's a folding tablet. I try to make that distinction, and you and me, buddy, we're gonna go down losing, but we're gonna go down swinging. It's a folding tablet that turns into a phone versus a phone that turns into a pocket watch. And those two experiences are very different. Dave Burns, I love it. Portable CD player motors with fine scrollables aren't an order of magnitude more complex / sarcasm. Could you imagine that? Like all the tiny little motors and drivers and batteries and actuators and everything that you have to do to put that in there just for it to go it's so annoying. Oh, Brian Billing. I mean, we know this playbook. I mean, they're playing the playbook with this now on the iPhone Pro. He says, Brian says, that's so depressingly accurate. Again, every single time techies race to the bottom on Android, you know for a fact that the counter argument is the Apples are more expensive, so they're betterer. And it's the flex. And people know the Apple market is more expensive, so when you show off the new Apple, it's a more desirable product. And you go into the carrier store and you get a 3-year lease deal on your new Apple, it looks better to you because you know it's the more expensive. Every single time tech journalists complain about price on every other product, why would you buy that new HTC mixed reality headset? It's $1,200. Oh, I don't know that it's worth it to buy that over getting an Oculus that you can get for $400. Sure, the HTC is better and it's higher resolution and it's got, you know, cool fans that blow the air through your face so it cools you, and it's got built-in diopters for people who need vision assistance, and it's got all of this wonderful technology. But really, if you're just going to play Beat Saber, couldn't you just do that on a cheaper headset? And then they give the market over so that Apple is always allowed to set a higher price on a first generation proof of concept dev kit every single time. It's always a race to the bottom on Android land. You can only accept the absolute lowest fire sale prices, sales, trade-ins, whatever. But Apple has always talked about it in a way where, I mean, sure, it's expensive. Oh, it's expensive. Apple's always going to cost. There's an Apple tax, guys. But it's always talked about it as if Apple is allowed to set that Apple tax price and no one else is ever allowed to justify a premium price tag for their products. It sucks. So that's going to wrap us up for the bulk of housekeeping here. I hope folks will take a gander through that editorial, just because the current way that we talk about foldables I find very troubling. And I think there's a huge consumer education gap on a lot of these new tech products that are coming out. If it's glasses or headsets or folding phones and folding displays, I worry that we're setting expectations really high and we're not properly, because again, I don't want to make the product sound like it's completely unbuyable. But also at the same time, I don't think we're setting the right expectations for how and where you should use this, what are the expected usage of this product, what does it do well in these various circumstances. And otherwise, you kind of get it and you open it, you're like, okay, well, now I have more screen space. Well, what do I do with that? It's the same argument that we've had with tablets. Well, a tablet is a solution in search of a problem. And then techies just stop. And you're like, well, couldn't you talk about some of the problems that it solves? Oh, we couldn't possibly do that because it's a solution in search of a problem. You know, I said this buzz phrase that people understand and they knowingly nod along with. Oh yeah, tablets. What can you even do with them? They're solutions in search of problems. Well, but they do solve problems. You could show people the problems that they solve. Oh, but then I'd have to do my job. That would get in the way of me making Apple videos. Apple case reviews. That's where the money is. Let me show you all these new watch bands for the Apple Watch. Sorry. Now I'm getting really punchy. I'm on so many antihistamines right now. All right, let me take another drink of coffee. Maybe I'm under-caffeinated. Yeah, mini me 1231. They all have iPad Pros for $1,500. Or for me, it's always hilarious. They're like, oh, these smartphone cameras. Who's really even going to shoot anything on a smartphone camera? And then you see that they're working on like cinema grade gear for their YouTube videos. And you're like, yeah, yeah, that's why you don't get why an improvement to a phone camera is kind of a big deal, because you're shooting this on like an Arri Alexa for your YouTube channel. Why would you do that? All right, sorry. Now I'm getting punchy. I'm getting real punchy here. One more from Pakistan. The question is, would foldables follow the 3D monitor TV path, aka die a slow death after a decade of marketing push? So here's the thing. I've been talking a lot about XR glasses. And I wrote an editorial 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. Are AR glasses a sham? And someone wrote me a message, and I think they were calling me a huckster. But it was a teachable moment. And to them, they were saying, like, hey, you're calling this AR, but it's not really AR. And I think all these companies are just in this for the short term to get a whole bunch of money and then walk away from the market. And that's not really how this kind of product development works. So like if I'm using glasses as an example, and I think I'll lead into why I feel this way for folding phones too. So here are my X-Real Air, 1080p micro OLEDs. They connect over a USB-C cable with little speakers, and they have sensors built in to do basic 3-degree head tracking. So up, down, left, right, and angle. Do I believe that this is the end of the journey? no, this is a decently polished second step into the market of getting consumers to put projector displays on their face. What we will be playing with next year will not resemble this. It will have iterated away from this. And what I'm hoping we'll be playing with in 5 years will make this look like a Tinker toy. I kind of feel like the same thing needs to happen with foldable displays. To me, it's a little like the promises of crypto and NFT and blockchain technologies. We look at what it does today. I'm sorry, I would be holding up. My Pixel Fold is way over there, and I just don't feel like picking it up. And obviously, they're going to iterate and improve. Sure, that's a foregone conclusion. That is not any tech Nostradamus there. That's no, you know, grand insight. But it's a market that addresses one idea of use today, and what we might learn from it, we might evolve out of it. In 5 years, we might all decide, like, hey, we had this experiment, we were playing with a tablet that can turn into a phone. Cool. But maybe someone just needed a mini tablet, and it could be their phone. It is still shocking to me that I can't use, like, an iPad mini as a phone. And maybe that becomes its own product segment. You know, there's the possibility Microsoft makes Windows on ARM more accessible to more consumers at better price points, and you can staple on a really inexpensive 5G radio, and then you just don't really carry a phone like you used to carry a phone. You know, to me, it's what we learn from each one of these little stances should be an evolution over time, and our products, these products that we're playing with today, should vanish. They should disappear. We shouldn't be looking at the same form factor of the Z Fold after 5 years, because it doesn't really feel like Samsung has learned anything from that. Oh, we made it a little thinner. That's not evolution, that's iteration. And that's why we start to feel like this is kind of a failed experiment, because we're not seeing, well, from Z Fold 1 to Z Fold 4, what did you learn? What improved? How did you make it better? What did you bring to the table? What else did you disrupt in this market? And we kind of get stuck. I've been so hot on these XR glasses because the solution before these was like wearing a humongous bulky VR style headset just so that you could sit and have a 720p movie theater out like 100, 200 feet away from you. And it was cool 11 years ago. It was cool that we had that tech, but like you had multiple cables sticking out your skull and you had to plug it into a nice computer or like a high-end at the time, a really expensive sort of TV video solution, like a Blu-ray player or something like that. Like all of these things had to be like kind of constructed around you so you could sit in a comfortable chair and have a solitary movie theater experience. And now, for like a third the price, maybe even a quarter the price if we account for inflation, you can pack these, wear them on the go, power them from a phone. I mean, that's the kind of evolution that we've seen. 11 years ago, we had this bulky home theater cinema headset experience. That does not exist anymore. That's gone. Even if you look at like an Oculus, it is so much nicer going to a VR headset than what we had before on that Sony Cinema headset. So that's what we should hope. We should hope that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what we're playing with today should not exist. It should have disappeared by then. And from there, hopefully we're working with new exciting technologies that bring better integration and accessibility to all of these different products. That was a really long answer to your question. Sorry.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Yeah, Raymond, I keep telling people these things are pretty cool. There we go. Glasses would be great. I don't have a TV in my trailer, so glass to my phone with Netflix would be great. I really like them for those kinds of like space constrained travel. It's pretty cool. And then once you start mixing them, like I was sitting in bed and I had my Nreals on and I was using them as like a second monitor to my little laptop. I'm writing in bed, but I could have like a big old screen. I was watching My Cousin Vinny on that. And I was doing some writing from the laptop display. And it was like I was sitting here in the office with my multi-monitor set up, but like in bed and comfortable. And it was pretty nice. I really wish more people would give them a try just for the literal display aspect of it. The AR stuff is just fun. It's an add-on, but like sitting down and just having a screen is such a huge step up for so many products. I let my daughter play a couple rounds of TMNT. Like, you don't really want to let kids like mainline displays on their face, but like it was the most exciting I think I've ever seen her play TMNT, Shredder's Revenge. So she on her own, she's playing by herself because obviously I can't see what she's seeing, and you can see on her face like, oh, she's kind of fighting some foot. Oh, she got the pizza. That was pretty cool. And then she gets into the fight with Bebop. And you see her like perk, and she's like, let me do this. And she's lying on her bed. Her head's just kind of on one of those like reading pillows, and she's holding my Steam Deck, and she's not like looking down, like closing off her throat to look down at the Steam Deck that's on her lap. She is staring up at the ceiling, and I see in her eyes, just from like the sideways view, I see in her eyes like, oh, this is the boss fight. Because, like, suddenly she's, like, paying attention. She's getting more serious about it. She finally beats Bebop. And you see, like, the look on her face. It's, like, those kinds of things, like, it was such a personal little experience for her. But it was so insightful for me to see, like, this gave her a level of immersion that she hasn't experienced before with other content distribution methods. So, I don't know. I'm really positive on these things because they're expensive. But they're, like, nice TV expensive. And how do you pack a nice TV if you want to travel? Like, I've got a really nice, like, TCL 6 series. It's 60-inch TV. It's bolted to my wall. I don't put that in my suitcase. I was such a huge fan of LG products, but, like, LG putting a 27-inch television in a briefcase is such a bad play. Like, what you could do with a pair of glasses versus like lugging around a battery powered television in a briefcase. To me, they're just not. What one is such a regressive and reactionary reflection on a cynical aspect of the consumer market. And the other feels like science fiction. The other feels like the future when you put some glasses on and then you have this amazing display projected out in front of you. So anyway, moving on. all of the rambling that we've done today, so that was 40 minutes of housekeeping. All of the rambling, all of the links, all of the show notes, everything will be available on this week's blog post for the show, somegadgetguy.com. And I do want to chew through the news block because these are all stories we should be keeping track of and then see like how we kind of come out the other side of some of these elements. So, somegadgetguy.com, catch all these weeks, all of the stories from this week's show. Starting off, if there's a politics aspect to technology, we tend to cover that first. And one of my favorite commentators in this space, Elizabeth Warren, is saying the Senate should investigate Elon Musk's role in thwarting an attack on Russia's Navy. Sorry, I just had a little cough there. Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts said Wednesday that the Senate should investigate tech billionaire Elon Musk's alleged role in thwarting a Ukrainian drone from attacking Russia's naval fleet last year in the Black Sea. Quote, "We need to investigate how this happened, what's in those contracts that permits him to have this kind of power," Warren said to reporters outside a forum about artificial intelligence on Capitol Hill that Musk participated in with other major tech CEOs. So this is all tied to SpaceX and Starlink being offered to Ukraine as a data connection tool, and often going down right at the time that we would be looking at things like using data-connected devices to engage in actual warfare. So it would seem, again, without an investigation, we don't know what the situation really resembles, but it would seem that SpaceX is making decisions on who should get information in real time in the middle of a war zone. And that so far, it would seem that that information tends to flow in one direction. And if there is an opportunity to disrupt a Ukrainian action, that SpaceX and Starlink seem to go down right in the middle of those kinds of coordinated communications. So the only way for us to know and not just make these kinds of feelings-based examinations of the situation would be to do a proper investigation. So I don't believe a billionaire in charge of a private contractor should have the ability to make those kinds of decisions on how information networks are being used in a way that would kind of run into direct foreign policy agreements. So yeah, I really do feel that there is something here worth investigating just to see what are the ramifications of these kinds of moves. At some point, and especially with all of the ill will that Elon Musk has generated over the last couple of years, I feel we need to have some really frank conversations about the future of programs like NASA and whether or not we're going to take a look at a company like SpaceX. And while they've done some incredible work in this area, you know, launching rockets, getting content and getting materials up into space, I'm also very concerned about their reliability record, their track record for safety, you know, the rockets that have exploded in some of their testing, and also where they go to make some of these decisions based on things like tax breaks. I don't feel like that's in the United States' best interest, and maybe in 5 or 10 years we need to have a frank conversation about sort of nationalizing SpaceX. Maybe we buy it as taxpayers and we fold it into NASA and we make that part of our space industry. And it would be great if we could kind of rekindle some of that passion for science and technology like we had in the 60s. And maybe one way to do that would be to just acquire what that company is doing. That's more than what this article is trying to handle. In the meantime, we also need to have a frank conversation about how does Starlink work and why does it not work when we need it to work? And that's fair. I feel like that's necessary. Yeah, Michael Corcoran, I feel like the political conversation surrounding this is we've defunded NASA, we've scuttled the shuttle program, which I believe was correct. I feel like the shuttle program never really materialized into being what it was promised. But at the same time, we had a whole bunch of politicians advocating for private industry instead of a public resource. And now we're sort of beholden to the whims of these private industries. And that doesn't suit taxpayers, it doesn't suit scientists, and it makes everything more expensive in the long run when we don't have control over that stuff. Or I should say, it'll make things cheaper in some ways, but also less safe. And I really appreciate when we could have those conversations at NASA after tragedies in NASA's history, where, yeah, the shuttle program became significantly more expensive. And you have to point to, well, what is the cost of your astronauts' lives? You need to make sure that this is not only correct, but that it is as close to infallibly correct as an organization can make. And that's a maddening experience when you're trying to talk about, like, oh, but NASA's budget ballooned and then this happened and then, oh, it got so expensive and private industry can do it cheaper. And you're like, yeah, they can do it cheaper, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people are always going to survive it. Oh, well, that's what you need to do when you want to pull a capitalism. I guess people sometimes just need to die. So it's pretty rough. I really wish we weren't as entwined in private industry for this type of research or this type of space travel. And it's interesting to see because, like, all of the branches of the military in the United States are also working on their own sort of platforms and programs to, like, get material up into space. Like, I forget, it was like the Navy is even working on some type of pilot program for launching materials into space. Apologies, I'm basically going to be cutting out, like, in the middle of every article here just so that I don't cough directly into this microphone. It peaks. Like, every single time I mute and then I cough, I can see, like, red line! It's real bad. Another story we just want to keep an eye on, I'm very interested in seeing how this rolls out and whether or not there's going to be kind of a lengthy appeals process, because I'm not sure exactly what the EU's handling of this kind of information is going to look like. Like, they say that this is the fine and then you're done, or is there going to be a whole back and forth like we have more in American court situations? TikTok fined 345 million euro over handling of children's data in Europe. TikTok has been fined 345 million euro for breaching privacy laws regarding the processing of children's personal data in the European Union, its lead regulator in the bloc said on Friday. Chinese-owned short video platform, which has grown rapidly among teens around the world in recent years, breached a number of EU privacy laws between July 31, 2020 and December 31, 2020, Ireland's Data Protection Commissioner said in a statement. It's the first time ByteDance-owned TikTok has been reprimanded by the DPC, the lead regulator in the EU for many of the world's top tech firms, due to the location of the regional headquarters in Ireland. So again, notice the dates on that. We're talking about infractions from 2020. So now the DPC is actually starting to probe materials from TikTok starting in 2021. And if the statute of limitations is long enough on these types of data protection, and again, I'm using phrases like statute of limitations, I'm not even sure if EU regulators use the same language in codifying for what length of time will these infractions be monitored. But going back 3 years, they're throwing €345 million fines. That's around $370-ish million over at TikTok. And that's just one block of one regulators in the EU. That, to me, is actually a pretty decently sizable first step in reining in how big data technology companies are doing business. Like last week, was it last week or the week before? We talked about Google getting a $90 million settlement out of their location tracking nonsense. And you're like, that was a business practice that Google profited from for years and years and years of Google Maps and Wi-Fi tracking and location tracking and GPS data mishandling. And they got a less than $100 million fine. This is the kind of data that Google generates that profits them billions of dollars. And they got like a $90 million fine. 1 year of mishandling children's data out of the EU for a 345 million euro fine is a step in the right direction. So I'm hoping that we'll see some of this actually kind of play out in the courts, look at what the regulators start digging up, and whether or not these types of data protection policies actually generate some kind of policy change from the companies that are doing business and are tracking all of our information. Like, I feel Google is probably due a market correction on how Chrome and Chromium works. We got so pissy with Microsoft putting a web browser in Windows, and yet chrome and chromium are sort of, again, it's an order of magnitude more invasive and more consumer lock-in than what we saw from Microsoft in the classic Internet Explorer days. So that kind of evolution of regulatory policy is long overdue. As these companies have moved from being like little startups in garages in Northern California, they're now trillion-dollar entities. And our fines are like, you did an oopsie, so here's a $10,000 fine per infraction. And you're like, okay, well, what does that add up to? Like $5 million. You've learned your lesson now, trillion-dollar company. There you go. Oh, Gormlord, I'm with you on that. Gormlord says, poof, needs jail time if you ask me. And I'm on board for that too. I feel, unfortunately, we have to take this in more measured steps. Just as, like, no bankers have gone to jail for, like, the housing market collapse back in 2007. It's going to take some time. Oh, that's not going to come right away. But I feel with an escalating regulatory industry that's starting to catch up to the realities of big tech and big data in the modern era, that at some point, you're correct. At some point, we need to be able to say if corporations are people and money is speech, then at some point when there is an infraction, that individual needs to go to jail. It's gonna have to happen at some point. Let me drink some water here. I'm gonna get back into the swing of things here. Hold on 1 second. All right. Oh, Dave Burns. If only. Dave says, I'm excited for a market correction that deflates the global economy back down to reality. The era of cheap money is over. Oh, if only. It's like our Disney princess wistful. Oh, if only that could happen. And then a hummingbird lands on my finger and I just sort of lightly pet it and it's super sweet. Speaking of doing the business, I am not an investment strategy guy. I am not playing the stock market in any sort of intelligent way, but I find following the stock market to be fascinating. Arm recently launched an IPO, and it did rather well. $65 billion NASDAQ debut. And this is written up, this is published over at Reuters from Manya Saini and Caroline Veletkovich. Whew, I mispronounced both of your names, and I apologize. Shares of SoftBank Arm Holdings closed a volatile session on Friday, a day after a stellar NASDAQ debut that valued the British chip designer at $65 billion. Stock fell 4.5% to end at $60.75 after trading as high as $69 earlier in the session. Major U.S. stock indexes declined Friday as chipmakers dropped amid weak consumer demand concerns. NASDAQ was down 1.6, SPX fell 1.2, and while an index of semiconductors sank 3%. So why IPO? I kind of don't get it. I know why IPO. So basically they said, you can own a piece of our company, and then we get, apparently, $60 billion to put out pieces of paper that say, now you can yell at us when we don't make you more money. I have a hard time with this generation of value and wealth for the people who sort of own the umbrella sides of these corporations. And whether or not that money into so the idea of an IPO makes sense. I'm not trying to like completely dismiss 100 years of capitalism here. The idea is you get people to invest in your company and that provides you with capital so that you can invest in other strategies and you can develop new products and then that helps your company grow. And then the side benefit of that is as your company grows, you provide more value and worth to consumers and then everyone's happy and supposedly making more money. But in our current flavor of cancerous growth capitalism, why IPO now? We're in the middle of downswings in a number of areas. I read another report. I didn't put it into this week's show notes. I read another report that the global smartphone market is looking to be down about 12%, half year over half year. At the same point of time last year, we're down about 10 to 12%, depending on what analysts and shipping data that you keep track of. PC sales are down. Apple, like Mac sales, were down an astounding amount before this most recent round of announcements from Apple. Like, I don't get the timing on an IPO now. Because the only thing that seems to impress shareholders is AI. It's like the buzzword for traditional investors is AI. The buzzword for like hip, trendy dude bro investors is crypto or blockchain or NFT or also AI. They're both impressed with AI. But that's just the fad of the moment. Like, if you didn't say AI in this keynote, your stock drops 3%. And notice how, like, Apple was even like, oh, yeah, and we're working on this and Siri and we're making these inroads and we got a GPU that does, better lighting effects in your games. But also, look at all these neural cores in the A17 Pro. And our chips are going to do the AI and the machine learning and the neural processing, too. And then Apple stock took a rally. Has nothing to do with the actual performance of your company. Has nothing to do with whether or not your company is making more money in the history of any other company. It only has to do with the perception of your company as it pertains to shareholders who are not a part of these industries. And I don't understand Arm's rush to putting that out right now. I believe they're still wrapping up litigation with Qualcomm. Risk is becoming more and more popular as a side investment for a lot of high technology firms. We're looking at intense competition from AMD and Intel looking at things like server space and functional consumer technologies, low power products. Apple is kind of running off on their own series of chips, even though they're ARM licensed. You know, ARM is not making as much money on Apple gear as they are on like Qualcomm gear. And all of these companies are sort of antagonistic to each other. And on top of all of this, ARM has not made a lot of noise about AI. They're trying to say, oh, we're going to be a leader in this AI space. And you're like, cool, how? Because right now, the biggie is like NVIDIA. And ARM is not developing the kind of technologies that are going to give NVIDIA a run for their money. They are contributing to the technologies that have already kind of been brought forth by their partners on other platforms. But they themselves don't seem to be a driving force in AI. So what are we doing? I don't understand why now was the time to roll out the IPO. And it launched high because ARM can make that argument. Yes, we are a massive force in almost every single consumer technology that you see out in the world today. We're the backbone behind companies like MediaTek and Qualcomm and Samsung and Cool. But that's not enough to get investors excited because investors don't know and don't care about the actual reality of how this market segment functions. They only care about the perception. And the perception is ARM couldn't get sold. They were going to get bought out by NVIDIA and that would have made people billions of monies. And they don't have active functional products in the hottest tech sector of AI. I kind of understand when the stock takes like a 5% dip after the IPO and then people start, oh, bear market for ARM's IPO. It's a bear stock. It doesn't have legs. It's going to start. I called it. So now So they got all this money, and then their stock dips 4%. It's actually back up a little bit higher in early trading this morning. But now we're just playing with imaginary money again. The value of the stock has dipped below what they earned on the acquisition of stock from these new shareholders. So technically, they're in the red. But they're not, because they acquired all this money from the shareholders at a certain stock price. But now they need to show that they can deliver value to the shareholders who are now underwater on their stock. I mean, it's, why put your company through that? I don't understand. What was ARM lacking that they couldn't develop the next generation of new technologies and sell them and earn profits and invest those profits back into the company to further the development of new technologies. I mean, they've got this perfect window. Risk is going to be years away from being a mainstream consumer competition gadget, or mainstream consumer competition chip against what ARM can deliver. And they're starting to make these crazy inroads with other developers working on like ARM servers. I think Amazon is now using a whole series of ARM servers with like hundreds of cores of compute power built into them. So this one boggles. It hurts my brain trying to figure out, like, are they really in that bad a shape? And if they are, then we're talking about a crisis of executive leadership yet again, and why would I invest money in that company? To me, the IPO seems desperate that they're timing it in the current market that they're timing it, that they're releasing this in. I don't understand. I do not understand why they're making the play now. I understand why they want to make the play. I don't understand why it was so precious for them to make the play now. Let me take a drink of coffee. We'll look at a couple comments here. Dave Byrne says, Tesla doesn't pay a dividend. Stocks are used as leverage for large banks to loan tax-free monies to billionaires as collateral. That's true. JGJ is saying, because BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, and private equity demand profit? They do. So again, it always seems like it's a bad idea when your company gets bought out by some kind of like firm that exists. You know, it's kind of like Richard Gere's job in Pretty Woman, right? Once your company is sort of acquired and then you're like, okay, well, when is it going to get dashed on the rocks and broken up into small pieces and sold off as scrap? Like, at what point does that happen? Go Starscream 1, haven't you heard? It's because it'll go right back up again. Line always goes up. Simon says, Hypno, the stock market is proof that human perception of value is ultimately very flawed. Yeah, very disappointing. This is a very good question, and I am not qualified to answer it. Could Apple ever buy ARM, or will it be another ARM and NVIDIA disaster again? So, in terms of capital, in terms of just pure liquid, I bet you Apple could just go pay cash for ARM. But I don't see... It doesn't benefit Apple at all to do that. Apple would be in charge of this firm, and they would have contracts and liability on supporting the intellectual property of every other chip manufacturer in the world that uses an ARM SoC. So Apple doesn't want to be responsible for that. They only want to make products that break compatibility with the rest of the market so they can make their competition look like they're making problems when really they're the problem. So if Apple does that, they would be under heavy regulatory scrutiny, and Apple doesn't want to be under heavy regulatory scrutiny. They just want to be able to break products and have journalists praise them for making terrible proprietary solutions to standards that already exist. Also, like I said, there would be some regulatory pushback. And then also, they have one of the best sweetheart deals with ARM licensing already. So they get all the benefits of kind of having access to ARM technologies, seeing what the ARM roadmap is going to be, not contributing anything to the future of high technology, and then getting to kick back and make their own proprietary gear. So they have the best of both worlds already. I don't see where they would take on the financial hit and the regulatory risk of trying to acquire this outlet, to try and acquire ARM and get less for their money. I just think that's probably not what they're going to do. Let me move this around. Okay, so just another quick follow-up. There was a lot of gnashing of teeth over... Hold on, I'm going to take a drink of water, then we're going to get into this next story. I'm trying to see if I can keep the flow going. I can't keep the flow going. My voice and my sinuses are shot. Hold on one second. man, I can't get my ears to clear either. I've got like really stuffed up ears. Much gnashing of teeth over this last week over Unity. Unity changing up their fee structure. Unity is a game platform. People build games using the Unity engine. I'm grossly oversimplifying, but they were going to change up their fee structure based on the number of installs, and they were going to retroactively charge, this is really complicated, but basically, every single time you installed the game, that would count towards the number of installs, and after your game reached a certain number of installs, you would have to pay Unity a different fee structure based on that. And it was going to apply to old games, so it was retroactively applied, and not just new games. Like, often when you hear about things like a fee structure, the magnanimous gesture is to say, moving forward, if you put out a new game using the Unity engine, this is the new fee structure that you're going to be engaged with. Well, they got a horrific backlash from the game developer community. Apparently, there have been multiple bomb and death threats, and some of them, it seems, from employees of Unity at their offices. And now, I believe it was this morning, or it was late afternoon yesterday. I caught it this morning. On a tweet, we have heard you. We apologize for the confusion and angst the runtime fee policy we announced on Tuesday caused. We are listening, talking to our team members, community, customers, and partners, and we'll be making changes to the policy. We will share an update in a couple of days. Thank you for your honest and critical feedback. So I'm not super encouraged by that reply, but they obviously see that substantial damage has been done to their brand, and searches for other game creation platforms and game developer tools have skyrocketed. Like, Godot was one that was mentioned a lot. Like, hey, if you're building this type of game and you want to use this kind of engine, you can check out this other platform of tools, and then, like, searches just spiked. And this is really kind of leaning into kind of the competition of how our games are made, produced, distributed, and monetized. And the people that are running Unity right now are a collection of executives that kind of come from that mentality of like increased advertising, microtransactions, all of the things that we gamers say we hate. And the Unity engine has often been used in a way where it applies to that kind of philosophy of more monetization, more interactions with the player to prevent them from progressing so that you can do this, you can do that. It doesn't always have to be that way, but if you want to make money on your game, Unity has kind of been attached to some of that philosophy. So it shouldn't have been tremendously surprising that they would continue to look at ways to squeeze. If we look at the Cory Doctorow the Cory Doctorow theory of impoopification of the internet, at some point, you start hurting everybody except for the people at the top who make money at your company and or shareholders who have invested in your company. So you start out with the product and you put it out for free and it just becomes cool. Well, then you start squeezing the users a little bit. You start making the experience for the users worse so that then it's better for advertisers to jump onto your platform and advertise and monetize to the users. Well, that's not enough. At some point, then you start squeezing the advertisers, and the advertisers start getting a terrible experience on your platform just to continue to try and reach the users who are having a miserable time on your platform, all so you can funnel even more money up the executive chain to the people who own the company and the people who invest in the company. And to me, I feel like Unity is well down that road now of that kind of impoopification of their product and or service. And so I'll be very curious to see in a couple days, hopefully we'll follow up on this next week, what their plan and proposal is. Because they seem to be stuck. They seem to think that they need to make even more money on their current base of users and the players who play games built on their engine. But the way that they went about doing this was horrifically ham-fisted, completely tone-deaf, and again, the worst possible timing that they could go through in the current economy where we're all getting squeezed hard on streaming services and inflation. Groceries at the supermarket are still stupid expensive. Why you would choose to do this now means you have zero executive vision and you have zero relationship to your consumers, and you have zero awareness of what people are going through day to day. It is astoundingly tone deaf, remarkably stupid. I have no idea how that happens. At what point does someone say, hey, I think this is a bad idea? And does that person just get like thrown out of an executive high-rise window? Like that terrible meme comic. What can we do to make more money? Well, what if we did this? What if we offered incentives? What if we helped them with that? What if we just didn't like rake them over the coals for install fees? Throw them out the window.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Thanks, Juan Carlos, for allowing me to be part of your show. And I want to introduce myself to you guys. My name is TK Bay, and I've been doing YouTube for quite some time, almost 10 years now. And you can find me online by just looking for TK Bay either on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. But the general consensus is I'm a tech reviewer. I provide an interesting way of approaching tech by the same way you would actually go ask your friend for help. That's generally the consensus of how my channel runs. I review anything from Android, iOS, PC computers, scooters, basically, you know, drones, anything that you think of as consumer tech. I generally try to get my hands on it and share with you guys my opinions. And of course, any troubleshooting or even tips and tricks that can help you enjoy your tech even better. Again, thank you very much to Juan Carlos. But if you'd like to check me out, just look for at TKDSL8655 on Instagram and Twitter, or TK Bay in YouTube.
Yeah, thank you, Gormlord. I couldn't remember. Gormlord says, there's a scummy ex-EA executive that is a part of all of this. Surprise, surprise. I'm having these crazy conversations with parents, like, don't let your kids play these kinds of games. And it's crazy. Like, I'm showing parents, like, here's another active lawsuit against Roblox. Please stop telling your kid to get my kid to try and play Roblox. I'm not letting Lex play Roblox. Stop it. And I'm showing them like article after article, and like, here are all the social issues. Like, your 7-year-old has 1,500 friends in Roblox. What are you doing? This is just like a predator factory at this point. Or just, you're letting your kid play this game on the iPhone, and like, you're annoyed that your child is bugging you every 5 minutes because the game ran out of energy or gems or mission tokens or whatever. And you're like, well, I had to set a strict limit, not letting the kid spend more than this much every week on the game. What are you doing? Just like, you have an iPhone. Go get Apple Arcade. It's going to save you, personally, so much money if you're putting your kid on a weekly allowance for, like, gem packages in their favorite games. Or, like, Android, I know, has Google Play Pass, but I'm also really digging the Netflix game library right now. The WrestleMania game is pretty good. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Into the Breach. I let Lex play the Sonic Runner because, like, oh no, I ran out of little mission tokens. Well, you just got to put the game down for a minute. There is literally no monetization mechanic in this that's functional anymore because we pay for Netflix. It is insane to me. And I'm trying to talk to parents, and they all act like, oh, but it's just the video games. And it's fine. I played some Atari when I was a kid, and I know what's going on. And you're like, you guys are idiots. You are actively teaching your kids that the way to interact with digital entertainment is through the most grotesque gambling mechanics, and that they have to give up their time and attention to terrible advertisements. You have no idea what ad is going to be served to your kid just so that they can progress in this game. And there are so many amazing experiences to be had, and social experiences to be had, where you don't have to put up with any of that. It just hurts my soul. It's so frustrating. So yeah. Michael Peppertech Juan just stated why I fear Windows. I mean, lowercase w, Windows. You know, you get thrown out the window for having a reasonable response to an executive at a corporation. Awesome Possum, low-key Digimon Masters on Roblox is fire, lol. And you can enjoy it. I have to believe, Awesome Possum, if you are in my chat right now, you are a functional, at least, teenager? That you're not a seven-year-old. And you can navigate the waters of Roblox and the advertising and the social interactions on Roblox in a reasonable fashion. You can make that decision for yourself. Letting your kid just sit in front of an iPad playing Roblox, I don't even know, I'm pretty sure it's an iPad thing, to me is ridiculous. And I'm writing up these notes and I'm trying to see if maybe there's an opportunity to like go to my kid's school and say, I would like to do a video game night for parents and talk about what I feel are the three key issues that we feel are important for managing a child's relationship with a video game. And so we've got like the game content, we've got the game content is like the story, the art, the whether or not it's graphic violence, you know, everything that kind of just goes into the story and the game and the mechanics and the playability. Then we have like the social interactions and the encouragement from developers to engage with other people in the game. And then lastly, we've got to talk about the monetization. Because that, to me, is actually the most critical aspect of all of this, is are we just feeding our kids the dopamine hits of slot machines? There's a reason why, like, slot machines are heavily regulated in Las Vegas. There's no control over how these games can screw with your brain. That's the Wild West right now. And, of course, you know, mobile gaming eclipses console and PC gaming by an incredible factor. Because you have so many people just kind of wiling away on their phone, and they enjoy that kind of risk-reward, that kind of dopamine hit when the slot machine roll goes their way. If you like that, and you're a grown-up, go do it. But my daughter is seven, and I would prefer her not learning that that's what gaming is. When she wants to go to a casino in, you know, like her late teens and early 20s, I'm going to teach her poker, not blackjack, or go and play slot machines. I'm going to teach her that when you play against other players, it's a game. When you play against the house always wins. I mean, this is what's so frustrating to me, Dave, because Dave says should just be called mobile gambling at this point, in my opinion. And it's so frustrating because as soon as you bring up something like that, someone is going to rush out and defend their favorite gacha game and talk about how they're a responsible adult and you shouldn't be able to take that away from me. And you shouldn't call it gambling because gambling is when you put money into a system and you might win money back. So there's a semantic thing and it's important that we don't lose sight of, and I don't want you taking away. And you shouldn't be able to not sell steak because babies can't chew it. And it's just grief. It's just grief from someone who wants to watch a little animated waifu fantasy character shoot laser blasts at other fantasy beings, and then they enjoy the process of pumping money into that game. And I get it. There's something titillating about watching the rear camera view of a Honkai Third Impact character running around on your screen, but that's not enough for me. I just don't care. And I appreciate the gaming experience that can deliver something a little bit, you know, more interesting than just that. But I digress. That was a lot. So, you know, whoo. Simon says hypno. It's only gambling if you can't afford to lose. Screw the poor. We love whales. Pay more for a game. Pay more for a game. So yeah, it's pretty great. Technically, this is where we would be into the gadget block. I kind of want to chew through these pretty quick. Coming by way of Ars Technica, written up by Kevin Purdy. Go ahead, screen share. There we go. Apple will issue software update for iPhone 12 over radiation worries. Decision comes after other countries follow France and pull the iPhone 12 from their market. It's really nice that we're looking at the release of the iPhone 15, and the iPhone 12 was the first phone offering up 5G radios, and it was a battery life killer. And yet again, there is other regulatory examination of this phone years after it was the mainstream option. But again, at Ars Technica, it's really a shame that Ron Amadeo couldn't have written this, because I'm sure it would have been filled with all kinds of snarky digs at Apple just can't do anything. Oh, their modems are not good enough. They had to sign another deal with Qualcomm for modems, and they just can't do anything right. We know that someone like Ron totally would have skewered Apple, just as he takes every opportunity to talk trash about Google and Samsung and Android manufacturers. So I just felt like that was a missed opportunity there. But it is kind of curious to me that now we're looking at an examination of the radiation that a phone puts out and that it's too high almost 3 years after it was the mainstream option from Apple. And I feel like maybe we're just a little off the pulse there for the regulators. It's a shame that we maybe didn't jump on that when the phone was a little fresher in the release cycle. I feel like if it's important to protect consumers against the radiation of mobile devices, that maybe your regulatory industry, some kind of FCC-style industry, should examine that before the phone is shipped at scale to consumers. Call me a dirty socialist, but I feel like you want to get ahead of the potential abuse or the potential consumer harm of radiation, that would be the right time to do it. And then also, I do want to point out one sort of good story coming from Google. Here, let me screen share this. This is from the actual Google blog. Chromebooks will get 10 years of automatic updates, and this is retroactively applying to older Chromebook. So it's not just if you buy a Chromebook today, it's working backwards at least. Starting in 2024, if you have Chromebooks that were released from 2021 onwards, you'll automatically get 10 years of updates. For Chromebooks released before 2021 and already in use, users and IT admins will have the option to extend automatic updates to 10 years from the platform's release after they receive their last automatic update. And I think one of the things that's kind of interesting in a lot of this conversation, and when you kind of dig into the Help Center and some of the additional information, not just in their main blog post, Google at least is upfront about the commitments that they engaged with their manufacturing partners and how their manufacturing partners have to engage in support and driver and software commitments with all of the component manufacturers. So there was some mention, like some of these updates and some of these software OTAs, some of this is going to be delayed because Google is working with a manufacturing partner, and that manufacturing partner is working with component partners, and the manufacturing partner has to get updated software and drivers and support from the components, and then that kind of moves back up the chain so that Google can then deliver the finished update to the consumer. It's the first time in recent memory that I feel we've had that kind of disclosure. It's not just Google makes a Chromebook. Google talks to Acer, and Acer talks to Broadcom and Qualcomm and Intel and all of these other, and Realtek and all of these other companies. And it's not enough for Google to say, hey, we're going to update Chrome OS, because that's going to have a ripple effect. There was just recently another issue. I got an email from Rode Microphones, and they said, hey, if you're using any of our audio gear, you might not want to update to the newest version of macOS, because there's apparently a change in how macOS is handling audio configs, and it's breaking a lot of USB audio gear. This gave me like PTSD flashbacks to when I was doing home consulting on home recording equipment for like voice actors. You get these really artsy people who want to be able to record voiceover auditions from home. And every single time, without fail, that there was an update to Mac OS, I would get flooded with tech support calls. Because Apple does a miserable job. They are the worst at working with accessory manufacturers to make sure that when there's a massive change to Mac OS that changes how it interacts with accessories, that their accessory partners know about it beforehand, can have updated drivers, updated software, patches, fixes, ready, firmware ready to go. Apple doesn't do that. Apple pulls the plug, you're screwed until the company can fix it. And it makes the company look like they broke the product. Apple, with their own accessory partners, will always make it look like it's their fault, not Apple's fault. So the flip side of this is, hey, Google could put out a new update to Chrome OS. I just said the G word and five phones lit up on my screen. They, making Chrome OS, they could put out a new update to Chrome OS. Update all this stuff, fix all these security issues. You're running the latest and greatest version of Chrome OS. Just ship that to Acer. And then Acer goes, whoa, hey, this broke everything on our laptop. So the whole experiment, I feel, was definitely a failure. I despised how Chrome OS was end-of-lifed from an arbitrary date from when the platform started selling. So you could regularly run into situations where a consumer bought a brand new Chromebook, but it only had like a year of software support left. In fact, it's actually probably not that difficult to find Chromebooks that are actively being sold as new inbox products that are out of their original support windows. That is a very terrible strategy. As much hate as Microsoft products get and how complicated support can be and how annoying or frustrating all of the legacy software support could be, there's still a window of products where you might have made the transition from Windows 8 to Windows 10 to Windows 11. And if you could, if you landed on just the right sequence of hardware, build, and software updates, your laptop could get like another 10 years. Or no, wait, we're on Windows 11. So like another 7 years of software support on Windows 11 before it's finally end-of-lifed. I feel like that's a better way to do this. And now Google is walking in that direction. It's not as good, but it's so much better than what they were originally offering with Chromebooks. So I was really pleased to see. We talked about this a couple weeks back because someone did an expose like, hey, you could buy all these Chromebooks. They're almost completely out of support. We're talking about schools. Schools have to invest in this. They get money from the state. All of this stuff happens through taxpayer dollars. But then these Chromebooks can just be end of life. This is a miserable situation to be in. But now, at least, if you're deploying Chromebooks at scale, and if you've already started to fall out of the window of support, you have an opportunity to go back in and say, I'd like to keep getting updates for my laptop. Please and thank you. So right now, I've got this. This is like our primary web portal home computer. This is the Pixelbook Go. And this just got like a whole new lease on life. I need to go through and like clean this thing up because this gets passed back and forth between my daughter and my wife. And there are like little cracks in the casing. It makes a clicking sound when you open it. I have to be really careful because there's like a little gap crack in the hinge right here. This is kind of close to where the exciter for the display is. So that's a lot of electricity. We don't want to see that have a problem. But other than just the wear and tear of years of use from the two people who are hardest on electronics in our house, this thing has been gangbusters. Like, I know, I think it's 8th gen Intel Core i5. For what you would use in a home compute device for communication and schoolwork and a little, like, business work and some writing, spreadsheets, that kind of stuff, this machine has been baller and gets better battery life on average than a similarly equipped or even a more recently similarly equipped Core i5 Windows laptop. The Pixelbook Go has been just an absolute champ. So it makes me really happy to see that they're stepping up with some longer support. And hopefully that kind of helps the conversation build. Because outside of that, we can then have another grown-up conversation about what to do with all of these older Chromebooks, and we can start pointing people to other resources. Like, maybe it's just time to flash Linux. Maybe your machine is getting really long in the tooth, and you can put on a streamlined, low-power build of Linux, and you can find a whole second life for that machine again. That to me is where this stuff actually gets kind of exciting, is there's so much you can do to keep that laptop out of a landfill, and now we're getting some better support and component support. We're going back to the individual components and saying, we need updated drivers, we need updated firmware, we need better support. That's the right direction to start walking. That is the basic first step direction, but we have walked now in the basic first step direction that we should be walking in. Yep, baseball super. I saw reports that some Chrome OS Chromebooks giving 10 years of support. I should have saved it. Dave Burns, but e-waste is so profitable. Won't you please think of the shareholders? DTNL, wait a minute, this is good news. Pours out a non-alcoholic cold one. Cheers, boys! I'm just like, again, in these kinds of articles, it's great to me because, like, the article, some of the editorials have been filled with, it always should have been this way. It was always so bad that that Google did this and that Chrome OS, and oh, it was always a problem. And you're like, yeah, we're all remembering that it was bad, and now they're changing it. So isn't that a step in the right direction? Isn't that good? And you never get the tone of it's good. You only get the tone of it was bad. And I love that. It's hilarious watching, like, the attitude. iPhone 12s are irradiating your brain, and Apple's going to put out a patch. Apple's doing the right thing for iPhone 12 owners, finally addressing that radiation issue. But where's the ire? Where's all of the editorial digs, you know, the elbowing in someone's ribs? Remember, Apple did this, it was real bad. And we never seem to have that consistency of editorializing for all companies. It always seems to go in just an away from Apple direction. So yeah, it's pretty bad. Michael Corcoran, Apple was actively selling the Watch 3 8 months after it got its last security patch. But you needed to be able to sell a cheap Apple Watch, right? Why do you hate... oh, excuse me, I couldn't get to the mute button in time on that cough. Why do you hate capitalism? Apple needs to make money on their old surplus of watches. That makes sense. You know, if someone needs to sell an old Chromebook, that's bad. That is a consumer harm, that they will be lacking support, they won't be getting updates. But it's different when Apple does it, because Apple needs to make money. So I feel, Michael Corcoran, that you are a hater, and you don't like capitalism, and I just feel like you need to be better. Just do better, Michael. Remember, when Apple does something like that, it's a good thing because they can make money on their old products, and then people can buy those products at a lower price. But if it's a Chromebook, well, then we need to have a class action lawsuit. So there you go. Oh man, Santiago, I haven't seen this. I just noticed YouTube app have no descriptions in videos, just went to the original install version on my Xperia. I'm gonna have to check that out. I do not like the most recent refresh for the YouTube app, because it's like live commentary if you're doing a stream and comments exist in this one tiny strip that you've got to swipe, and it is yet another ratcheting away from conversations on YouTube. It hurts the discoverability of comments. You have to go looking for where this stuff is. No one takes the time to do that. And like I said last week or the week before, I'm seriously considering just disabling comments on my videos. If you want to leave a comment, you can go to my web zone at somegadgetguide.com. it's like YouTube is going out of their way to make the relationship between content creator and audience more and more difficult with every single app update. And it's miserable. From Mini-Me. Most Android reviews I see on YouTube, no matter how good the product is, they always remind you that one time, four versions of Android ago, that it would slow down. And you're like, hey, you remember when Apple used to throttle your battery? They would put in a purposely undersized battery that would degrade after a year. Once it would get to 2 years, then they would tell the software, harm the consumer experience and make it as slow as possible. And we don't ever get the same editorializing, regurgitating all of that. It was like, you know, at the last days of LG, I'm holding up an LG V60 and someone would still have to crawl out of the weeds and go, oh, but the LG phones boot loop. And you're like, the Fruity Boot Loops were 4 years ago, but cool. Last article that I had linked here that I want to talk about. If you are planning any kind of PC upgrade or console upgrade, if you're looking at storage specifically, now would be a really good time to shop. Prices on SSDs are very competitive right now, and we're looking at the entire SSD market, led by Samsung first. All of these companies, at the same time, completely independently of each other, mind you, there is no collusion happening. All of these companies are looking at radically scaling back on flash memory chip production, well beyond the current consumer demands. So we've been talking about, like, phone sales are probably going to be down about 12%. We would expect there to be a market shift in how much flash memory is made for phones. We're seeing PC sales are down across multiple product segments. We would expect SSDs for PCs. We would expect that flash memory to be down a certain tier as well. As near as I can find, Samsung is looking at something roughly near a 50% reduction in their manufacturing capacity, so that as we get into the end of the year, SSD prices will rebound, so that you will pay more for SSDs. Now, again, there is no collusion in this market, even though Samsung has been caught regularly colluding with RAM and SSD manufacturers for decades. One of Samsung's major tactics is price-fixing components. They've been caught price-fixing displays, price-fixing whole phones, LCDs and OLEDs, mind you, price-fixing RAM, price-fixing everything they can. That is one of their major tactics. If they need to make more money in a product segment, they don't just offer a better product and sell it at a competitive price. They reach out to their competitors and say, hey, we'll all make more money if we all raise our prices the same. So they can't just do that, because they were caught several times just raising prices. But if there's less supply out in the market, well, then all the prices will climb. So now, if we had a free market, right? If this were capitalism in the ideal sense of, like, libertarian tech bros telling us, you know, like, oh, this is the free market at work, wouldn't you think, like, Hynix or Micron would walk into this space and say, hey, Samsung is going to be reducing their supply, which is going to raise prices. So we could do something similar, but we could still undercut Samsung and we would sell more products. We would make more money and all the consumers would be happy. Maybe there'd be a little bit of a price bump just to account for all of this kind of chicanery. But no, that's not what's happening. So this is a press release coming from TrendForce. I'm going to take a little drink of water here, and then we're going to kind of dig into this here for just a sec. All right. NAND flash prices expected to stabilize and rebound in quarter four, projected to remain steady or increase 0 to 5%, says TrendForce. In response to persistent softening in demand, Samsung has taken a decisive step a sweeping 50% production cut from September, with the focus mainly on processes under 128 layers. According to TrendForce's research, other suppliers are expected to follow suit and increase... I love this phrasing. Listen to this phrasing. Increase their production cutbacks in the fourth quarter to accelerate inventory reduction. I'm going to repeat that because it bears repeating. Other suppliers are expected to follow suit and increase their production cutbacks in the fourth quarter to accelerate inventory reduction. I adore the corporate spaghetti noodle speak of double plus ungooding things in the market. We're using all of the positive words we can in increasing and accelerating to talk about the reductions and the cutbacks. So I sort of shared some of these articles out on social media, and immediately, like, oh, but that's not really capitalism, Juan. Capitalism is the free market, and free market would have competition. So when Samsung scales is back, they're going to have competitors, and then people can make their choices. So you don't have to buy a Samsung memory chip. You can just buy from a competitor, and that's how you'll do seven capitalisms. And if you have seven capitalisms, you get a gift basket. And you're like, okay. It's not the libertarian idealistic definition of the word capitalism. But the reality in the market is one company makes a change and the other companies follow suit, and everybody seems to make the same change together at the same time, which doesn't benefit competition in the market. It only benefits the companies increasing profit sectors, not by building a better product, not by being a more competitive entity, solely by reducing demand all at the same time. And to me, that is another soft market collusion. And it kills me because it's like anyone who is a bootlicking capitalist business supporter needs to see like a smoking gun email. It's like, it's not market collusion unless someone can produce a document. Dear Mr. Hynix and dear Mr. Micron, I am Mr. Samsung. I would like to inquire with you if you would like to artificially raise the prices of your products at the same time that we do, so that we can make more money selling the same things that we've always sold with the same mature manufacturing that costs us less, all at the expense of the consumer. Not in a free market strategy, but in a grotesque illegal exercise of colluding with each other to harm the consumer. Love, Mr. Samsung. Send. And obviously we're never going to get that email. But we have a consistent track record going back decades to the 90s of Samsung playing with the market, getting ridiculously tiny slap on the wrist fines whenever they're caught, profiting billions on these kinds of business practices, and often working with these manufacturers. Like Hynix and Micron have shown up in these collusion situations numerous times before. And yet I'm still supposed to give Samsung the benefit of the doubt that maybe this time it's just a reply or a response to the market. Maybe this time that because cell phone sales are down 12%, I want to say, someone please correct me in the chat. I don't have the numbers memorized. I want to say PC sales are down an average around 20%. I don't know, somewhere in there. Maybe it's 30. But in response to those two markets being down, we're going to slash memory capacity manufacturing by 50%. So even if fractions worked this way, even if percentages worked this way, I'll add PC sales at 30% to cell phone sales at 12%. I'm still not at 50%. And that's not how flash memory sales work. That's not how the production of these chips play out. That's not what it... it's 8%, not what they're, it's an 8% profit gouge. No, that's not how this works. So, short story, yet again, incredibly long. If you're looking at a PC upgrade, a console upgrade, if you're just looking at, you know, anything that has flash storage in general, like, I just got a cute little Kingston SSD. It's a 1 terabyte, pretty decent read and write speeds. It bogs down a little when you hit it with like 200 gig of data in a single transfer. 1 terabyte, $65. That's pretty good. We're expecting that drive to be maybe 5 to 10% more expensive at the end of the year for being the exact same drive that it is today. I'm going through and I'm replacing some of my SanDisks. None of my SanDisks have nuked me yet. But just with all of the consistent issues that SanDisk has had in addressing the situation with their SSDs, I'm looking at some alternatives. And the Kingston looks like a pretty solid little bang for buck. I've got it right over here. I'm going to be doing a write-up on this. I might do just like a quick little two-minute video. Look at this. Like, it, little mini SSD. Back when we used to call these things thumb drives, like, it's almost the size of my thumb. Just a little taller than my stumpy thumb. And 1 terabyte, $65. This is going to be more expensive later in the year. If you're looking for a little portable drive, if you're looking for an upgrade for your laptop, for your desktop, now is the time to buy. And we'll have to see if this has any impact on things like memory cards and other storage devices. Like, I've got SSDs for my monitor, for my little Atomos. I'm not sure what that kind of impact is going to be like, but I would expect everything to kind of climb that uses the same NAND flash chips. So it could be getting pretty rough. The memory cards are a different type of storage technology, so I don't know. You know, like, I've got like a little micro SD card here. I don't know that these will be subject to the same price shenanigans, but we'll have to see. Michael Peppertech, 30% from, 30% from last year, 16% from first quarter to second quarter. Okay. Yeah, those are pretty substantial numbers. Getting ahead of those numbers, I still don't see where a 50% reduction in NAND is appropriate, except for saying we need to artificially inflate the price of SSDs again to where they were back when this technology was newer and more expensive to manufacture. When you talk about stabilizing and returning to a price tier on a product like that, that's not how technology should function. I know, now I'm being a little idealistic. Totally get it. Call me out on this. I'm putting on my hopeful, wishful hat of tech adoption. But, like, the current manufacturing process for NAND is a mature process, or is a more mature process. And we should be looking at that maturity leading to increased efficiency, and increased efficiency in manufacturing is often a way that companies make more money on their products. Sometimes that can be realized as reducing the price of the product as it reaches a more efficient manufacturing tier. But if you're just trying to tell me that all we're going to do is curb the supply so that the price artificially inflates, then that is not a competitive factor in the pricing of your product. And there isn't any, apparently, that I can find, there isn't any other outside pressure in terms of like supply of components or materials that would impact. It's not like where we were a couple years ago with like the silicon demand, like harming the ability to make processors and motherboards, and all these things were getting more expensive because we literally couldn't get the raw materials to make this stuff. No. We're not seeing any other of that market influence other than Samsung, Hynix, and Micron want to make more money on the same products that they've been selling for a while, and they've made enough that there are some out in the market already, and the demand has softened a little, so now we need to change the supply. Anyway, we got about 10 minutes to kind of wrap up the show here. I'm going to take a drink of water. What all do you want to talk about? We made it through all the news. I had way too much news. We did housekeeping for 40 minutes. What do you want to, what kind of questions do you want to throw out there? I'm going to take a drink of water.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio.
So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
McCorkran, this conversation prompted me to price SD cards and SanDisk, and SanDisk will sell you a three-pack of 128GB cards from this generation for $37. That's not too bad. I've been really climbing up now. There's a 512 in my Sony, and I have another 512 that I actually use with my Panasonics quite a bit. Is this the 512? Yeah, it's right here. So I keep it in the little micro SD to SD card. But yeah, like U3A2 high-speed card, 4K video, like it's pretty solid. I think it's kind of funny because like when I look at the storage that I bought with my Atomos, so this is a 512GB mini SSD, and this is a 512GB micro SD card. And I use both for recording decently high bitrate 4K 60 frame per second video from Panasonic cameras. Obviously, this gets a lot, this needs to be a lot more robust when I'm playing with like ProRes or some of the advanced codecs, like the sort of high-quality H.265 codecs. So you can't just say oranges-to-oranges comparison. This was a lot cheaper than this. But it is kind of funny to me, like this, like my brain looks at these two things and like, how can they be the same 512 gigabytes? There's the same gigabytes in this as there in this. And I just think it's kind of crazy to me. I started out getting really into like pocket PCs and Windows Mobile PDAs. And it was a huge deal when I could get like, when I could afford to add a couple 32 megabyte compact flash cards to go into a cradle that my iPack would slide into and give me the full like memory card slot for compact flash. And then I could pop in 32 megabytes. That's like a whole album of really high-quality MP3 music. And that card was expensive. And it makes me feel so old. I remember looking at those and thinking like, oh my God, this is like 30 floppy disks. I could hold a stack of 30 floppy disks. And here's this one little matchbook-sized card. That's incredible. So yeah, it's pretty funny. uh, Oh, Adichie Anil, have you ever thought of revisiting some budget IEMs? The Tri-Fi market has grown even more, and that sub-$100 range is kind of overflowing with options. I'm honestly a little intimidated by how many options there are sub-$100, and some of them are phenomenal, and yet I've got such a ridiculous collection of IEM-style earbuds already that, like, the comparative listening of trying to determine, like, well, what's a little different? What's the tuning? What's going on here? How's that working over there? And I have to be really selective, because if I do a bunch of earbud reviews back to back to back to back, it's a guaranteed it's another ear infection. So I am watching the segment with some interest, but I worry that we've kind of hit a peak of saturating what we can do with Chi-Fi. I'm a little anxious that it's like every day it seems I can find yet another earbud that is doing something interesting. And that to me is also kind of the point where the market is tipping in a direction where we kind of need it to scale back again. Like, I was at the mall with my daughter, and one of the collectible stores is basically just Funko Pops. And I don't understand how that stays in business, because the Funko Pop collector can literally not contain all of the Funko Pops if they wanted a completionist collection of Funko Pops. It is not possible. And even when you look at a theme, like, say I just wanted Marvel movie Funko Pops, that is still a quantity and a number of Funko Pops that is uncollectible. I mean, it's ridiculous. It is incredible. And I used to be one of those completionists in, like, oh, like, I really like CCA. If I want to do CCA, I want to listen to everything that CCA puts out. And like, that whole KZ-CCA linkover is, like, that is way too many earbuds for one person to experience. And at the same time, like, I've got some Ecos right in front of me, and I love these things. The little gems and the opals, those buds, they're phenomenal. And after a point, it's just, like, it's kind of exhausting kind of reiterating the same educational points on, well, this does this, and this is a little higher in the mids, this is a deep V, this is a smiley face, this is really bright and shimmery, you need to hit this with some EQ. And you're like, I'm telling the same story over and over and over and over again with finer and finer and finer and more minute differences. It's tough, because I still enjoy it, I have fun with it, but I feel if I really tried to tackle all of those releases, I would probably stop having fun. No one wants to watch those videos. They're not fun. So they're not fun. From Kenox 80, Lumix G9 thoughts. So I'm shooting this right now on a Lumix G9. The G9 Mark II was just announced, and it is a nice upgrade over the camera that I'm playing with. I'm shooting this from right now. The major upgrade for me would be... So first of all, I picked the G9. Do I still have the... I do. I've got two G9s, and I use them as sort of my in-studio production cameras. But increasingly, I've been relying on phones for a lot of my quick and dirty B-roll, because the sensor-level performance on something like a Xiaomi 13 Ultra is much closer to the sensor level performance of the G9 than a lot of camera enthusiasts would like to admit. This is my second G9, and I like Micro Four Thirds. Micro Four Thirds was the most affordable and accessible way to get 4K 60 frame per second video recording in any camera body. So you're using a smaller image sensor. It's smaller than APS-C. And I like the G9s because they use the same sensors as the same generation of GH. So this is a very similar sensor to what was in the GH5. And the G9 Mark II is very similar to the GH6. Excuse me, sorry. Couldn't get to the mute on that one either. But what's also really cool about these things, if you need to shoot more production grade footage, if you catch the feed out of the HDMI, that's why I have an Atomos Ninja, you catch the feed out of the HDMI, and it is a much higher quality video file that you're recording. It's an MP4 off of the built-in memory card. You can go ProRes, 422, 4K, 60 frames per second. And very few cameras in this price range, the sub $1,500 price range, were capable of doing that. So the G9-2 is going to bring better autofocus, and it would be compatible with all of my current lenses. But what I'm kind of budgeting for, and this is going to be a longer term strategy for me, because I'm using these a lot less, I really want to make the jump to a full frame system. And that means all of my investment in camera bodies and lenses and accessories, everything is dead. It is a complete dead end where I am right now. And I'm seriously looking at sticking with Panasonic and going with the S5 2X. Full frame, 60 frames per second, great video production features, but I'm going to have to invest in all new glass. And I am using these things so little right now that I've got to really strategically pace out how I want to manage that, because I want it to be a continuity of experience. It's not like I sell all my cameras and then I save up the money to then buy a new camera and get that camera in and then I can get back to work. That doesn't work. I've got to buy the new camera and then maybe on the back end I can make a little money selling off all my old gear. But if I sell off everything, I'm probably not going to make up the difference on the new camera body and the new lenses that I would need. So, sorry. Again, short story, incredibly long. The G9-2 looks like a monster. I love that it's got that new autofocus system in there. I love that it's using the sensor from the GH6, but I'm kind of stuck. So I'm probably not going to jump on a G9-2. I really still get a lot of mileage out of my G9s, and when I do make that change, I'm probably going to go to an S5 2X because the price difference is about $300. So if you don't have an investment in Micro Four Thirds lenses, the difference between a G9-2 and an S5 2X, a full frame camera sensor from Panasonic, all the same, like, it's very similar, I should say, all the same performance, bells and whistles, the things that you really want to look for in a good video focused, but also good stills photography camera, about $300. That's really close. That makes Micro Four Thirds kind of a harder sell for me in this current camera market. I want to say like G9-2 is somewhere around $1,800 and an S5 2X is somewhere around $2,100. I can't think of many situations where I would actively pick. I need to have the significantly smaller sensor camera. Off the top of my head, one of the only ones I can think of is the higher frame rate option, where I think you can shoot 4K 120 on the G9-2. You can clear the data faster from this smaller sensor than you can from a full frame sensor. I am happy to trade 4K 120 on a full frame on a interchangeable lens system to go up 2 to 3 stops of light off of the sensors to get much, much shallower depth of field for when I'm producing my videos. And they both have similar autofocus capabilities, so I feel I'd be in good shape there. I'm probably going to lean towards getting rid of all my Micro Four Thirds gear over the next couple of years. Oh, Gormlord, I need to complain about the people who even needs USB 3 speeds, though, referring, of course, to the iPhone 15. We knew this was going to happen. They drew their line in the sand. For years, they have been defending Apple and by saying things like, oh, plugging in a cable, I just airdrop everything. So now that you have proper USB 3 speeds, they still have to, again, they don't want to look like they're just Apple shills saying everything Apple does is correct. So they fall back on, oh, but I moved on. And I mean, it's good if you need it, but I am better than you and I like my wireless stuff. And as soon as they try to move some files over and you're like, oh yeah, wow, this is way faster, then that'll change. It was always a feature benefit of Android devices with USB 3. That was always downplayed by tech journalists and tech reviewers. And now that Apple does it, people can like it again. Yeah, McCorkran, exactly. The Samsung Evo is $35 for 512 gig. man, Samsung's got to cut back on that manufacturing. These drives are really good prices right now. So it's time to make consumers pay more for those drives. Michael Peppertech, this is a deeply philosophical question that I don't believe I'm qualified to answer. I know what you're asking, but I'm going to read you your comment literally, and I know that's not what you mean. Sorry, I'm not trying to make you sound dumb. Have technological caused an irreversible decline in intelligence due to reliance on devices rather than people thinking for themselves and postulating on new ideas? I do not believe so in the grand scheme of people interacting with technology across many regions and markets and areas. I think for the most part, we are still witnessing a net positive on people interacting with technology and deriving benefit from being able to more freely communicate and spread information. I think what we see, unfortunately, is a very loud demographic of a minority of the population that are trying to use these resources in ways that harm people, that distract and degrade the conversation, and it is a massive challenge. It is an incredible challenge facing the people who are alive today and the future generations on how do we make that kind of poop posting and disruption and the spread of misinformation unfashionable. How do we reclaim some of the authority of traditional news outlets without the same tools restricting the flow of information and gatekeeping who is allowed to comment and who is allowed to post? But in the long term, whenever we can deliver tools at scale that bring better information, better resources to a population of people, I see that as a net positive. And this is why we should be increasingly critical and vigilant against an organization like Facebook rolling into an area and subsidizing the tech rollout of that area and the communications network of that area, and then making Facebook the main internet for that population of people. And just as we kind of walked away from the early days, 56K modems and AOL walled garden experiences, the internet then became an incredible resource for people to communicate and to find peers and to share information as it rolled out away from your AOL email address and your AOL widgets. And that's what we need to continue safeguarding. That's what we need to continue investing in. And so that's a heady, and again, I'm speaking as from a tech utopian who at some point would appreciate a Star Trek style future for humanity. That's what I would like us to put our efforts towards. That's what I would like us to put our energy towards, to trying to maintain. There are 7 billion plus people on this planet, and very, very few of them have access to any kind of tech education or communications experience. And as soon as we bring more of those people up to speed and we empower them to share their stories and to contribute to these dialogues, then I feel we'll sort of usher in the next phase of what technology can look like. I still have high hopes for that. I think a lot of what you're talking about is absolutely a concern at an individual or a small pocket community level, and we need to be sensitive to that. But I feel as the grand scheme of technology, that's why I've been such a passionate advocate for competition and mobile products filling these roles. The person who is going to experience their first compute platform in this day and age is not going to experience that through a desktop PC. They're going to experience that from a low-cost smartphone, and maybe even a low-cost feature phone. And if we can empower them with that kind of communications equipment, and then we can provide them some tools like the ability to turn that phone into a more traditional compute platform through some kind of desktop mode, then I feel we have actually realized the vision of mobile technology. Otherwise, it's just toys for rich people. I mean, it's kind of what we are now. If we're not really building the bridge to the next billion users of the internet, then what good are we? Like, what are we doing? I don't really feel we're succeeding in this mission. I mean, it's really just better if I kind of bugger off and just make a dozen iPhone case reviews. At that point, why pretend? Oh, awesome possum. In high school, I had a 64 megabyte compact flash card in lieu of a flash drive because the flash drives were so expensive. Man, you remember those? We used to put little mini spinning discs in the frame of a compact flash card. I loved it. It was so much fun. Especially you would gut an iPod and put in compact flash storage instead of a mini spinning disc. And it made your iPod more resilient and ooh, faster read speeds. Ooh, I miss that tinkering. It was so much fun. Oh, from John Gao. Not very frequently in my line of work. John Gao is asking, how often do you need the additional codecs in the S5-2X and the S5-2? So, I mean, I've got quite a bit of some of that flexibility in the G9. And then when I go to my Atomos, like I said, I can move back and forth between like DNX, ProRes, and H.265. For my own internal production, I'm almost exclusively using the lowest quality codec, H.265. For me, it's just storage space. I shoot so much stupid B-roll content for even my low-level videos, and I archive a lot of it. So I'm working as low as I can for 4K at 60 frames per second. But I've done production shoots, and I've done some collaborations, and I've worked out in studios and stuff like that. And these cameras have actually left the Gadget Lab to shoot on sound stages. And that's when the Atomos really kicks in, and I'll switch over to something like ProRes HQ or something like that. And again, that depends on what the client's needs are. So switching over to something like the S5-2X would give me that flexibility. It would not be a purchasing decision for me, in that I also own things like an Atomos Ninja, where I can better control what the content coming out would resemble. And I also like things like having better guidelines and stuff like that. I like working off of the external monitor. But it would be a benefit, or it would be appreciated, where then maybe I could also double up footage. So I could be recording to the Atomos and recording to a similar codec on the camera body itself. And then you've got stuff in duplicate that is a little bit safer to kind of maintain. So to me, it's really like a, what are you trying to do with your camera? If I were only looking at shooting in my office, like, I don't need any of it. My needs are really low level. But as soon as you start talking about other opportunities to kind of step up production, then that's where I think those things really come into play. Oh, Muppinish. I've actually let that kind of drop. Muppinish asks, I'm curious, Juan, did you expand on the mining test or did you decide to drop it? I just genuinely haven't played with it much more. So Muppinish is acting, Muppinish was in my DMs and we were talking quite a bit back and forth that there are like sort of these crypto mining programs for phones. And it was an opportunity to look at how can we utilize the processing power of a phone to maybe do some other kind of work. And crypto is an interesting kind of case study in computational number crunching to try and achieve some kind of end result or end goal. And you can look at, you know, like what are your flops and what are your megabits and giggle pickles and all that other stuff. One of the reasons why I kind of walked back from that is the way that certain apps handle power management, I couldn't just run the program without also then forcing the screen to stay on too. And this gets weird. Like I don't want to be showcasing a benchmarking situation where if you want to try and generate crypto, you've got to leave your screen on while the phone is working as hard as it possibly can. And you might also be having to plug it in. Like I did some of those tests on a Red Magic. So the fan is kicking on, the phone is plugged in, I'm doing the battery saver powered charge separation tech, but the screen still needs to stay on. And there wasn't a good way of managing all of that in a way that didn't feel like you were just nuking the phone. So I need to follow up. I need to see if there have been any updates or improvements to the apps that are managing this kind of crypto mining. because I still think it could be kind of an interesting thing to take a look at. But what I need, what I feel like would be a consumer benefit in a mining situation would be a screen off method of maintaining a high tier of performance. So I haven't found a way that I can reliably use crypto as a performance test, but I should revisit. I completely fell off like looking at all the different parts and pieces. And this was also at the end of the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. So we had just gotten a few phones with the 8 Plus Gen 1, and I tried some of the crypto mining with those phones. And now I really need to come back and take a look at this with Dimensity 9200s, 8 Gen 2s, and the next generation of phones kind of right around the corner. Thank you for the reminder, because I really hadn't... I kind of just let it go. I really should take a second look at it. Muppinish, net positive, he says. I counter simply TikTok. Well, TikTok for Westerners, sure, but TikTok, the version of TikTok that's in China, has become an incredible resource for spreading good information to Chinese citizens. So you can counter with TikTok, but I'm going to come right back at you and say, TikTok. TikTok is demonstrating a high educational value for people who are using it as a platform for sharing better educational materials and not as a disruption in social media that it's being sent out to for the rest of the world. And so I feel it's also a very good case study in educating a population, and that's what it could be. But again, we actually have to have regulations in place against the use of algorithmically sorted social media being used as a distraction or as a weapon of misinformation. And that applies to YouTube, and it especially applies to Facebook and to Twitter, now X, and that's a problem. We need to be able to have a frank conversation about what maintains our right to free speech, but in a climate where we have to shoulder the burden of bad actors in our space attempting, or non-earnest participants attempting to spread bad information for their own benefit. Again, we end up with Trump presidencies and Brexit-style situations all because our systems can't weather the targeted application of misinformation on consumers that are extremely vulnerable to that kind of mental conditioning. And it started with Fox News, and it's escalating today. But you look at TikTok as a platform, and you can show, we can show TikTok as an educational resource can be incredible when someone comes in as an authority to say, you will only send good information to people and helpful information to people. We just need to find a way to do that without the same kind of authoritarian and social, what do they call that? The social points, their own like social standing, where you get judged as a Chinese citizen and you get a social score depending on your behavior. We just need to find a way to kind of mix and take some of the good ideas from good TikTok and bring them over into other social media companies. Oh no, Muppinish says, don't worry, I haven't had time to improve my mining cooler. We were looking at like, so if I get like a thermoelectric cooler and I strap it to the back of this phone, would I be able to generate, you know, mining results that would actually bring some kind of profitability before we would nuke the internals of this phone? It was pretty bad. It was so bad. Yeah, Dave Burns, the Chinese social scoring is actually closer to our credit score than I am comfortable with. So folks, we ran a little bit long. I'm really glad we had just this time to chat. We're rolling quickly into the end of September and the beginning of October, and we know that that's going to bring a ton of product announcements and new gadgets and new gizmos to play with. And I've got some videos that I've really got to finish up before we just get hit with the deluge of Techtober. But we've got some really fun stuff to play with. I'm going to go back and also check out some mid-ranger Vivos. I had the follow-up video talking about the X90 Pro. I'm hoping we get some word from OnePlus what's going on with their foldable soon. I mean, to me, I've been spending some quality time with the Pixel Fold, and I'm looking to wrap up kind of my experience review, my long-term review, as we start getting more info on OnePlus Fold. And then I think that's an interesting comparison point. Are the alternative foldables to something like a Z Fold 5? So we've got a lot that we're going to be kind of putting together in a way that will hopefully not just be me sitting in front of this camera and regurgitating specs and then having to spend a whole bunch more time shooting prettier and prettier B-roll, because that's really not been sustainable and YouTube has been pretty rough on that. So, folks, I hope everybody out there that you have an amazing week. We'll be following up some of this tech conversation with TK later in the week. And then also be on the lookout. Tuesday is Kimmy, Gadget Goddess. Wednesday should be Easy Computer Solutions. Thursday, I believe, Ike Talks Tech is back to regular streaming. Friday is LaShawn, if you just want like a fun, silly, goofy tech hangout. Michael Peppertech, please drop in the chat when you've been streaming more regularly too. Please correct me if I have that wrong. We can keep an eye out for El Jefe Reviews streaming on the weekends, and also the Nomad Tech Project with our good friends. I'm spacing their names, and I can see their faces, and they're going to make fun of me for that. But we've got lots of tech conversations coming up over this next week. Literally every day, you can find a good tech chat to jump into. And now that the sort of peak of the iPhone conversation has kind of crested from that marketing side, and people will be playing with their iPhone 15s when they get shipped, I think in the next week or two, we'll have an opening again where we can pretend to care about the whole rest of the tech landscape. Sam and Joe. I keep wanting to call him Reggie because it's an inside joke, and then I forget that Sam's name is actually Sam. And Sam deserves to make fun of me the next time he hears about me not remembering his name. So, folks, I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care of yourself so you can continue taking care of others. And I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.